Have you ever known a person to change, even yourself, perhaps? For now, I don't mean unintentional change, change for the worse, such as when a person starts drinking or stops smiling after the loss of a job or a marriage. Change for the worse, and people say, boy, she really changed. For now, I'm not concerned about that. Rather, have you seen anyone make a great change of lasting value? You know, it's rare. It's rare. So rare that people often say, you hear it, no one ever really changes. That phrase, no one ever really changes, was purged from my vocabulary through the course of 10 years during which I was visiting men at Attica Prison every other week or so. I've been in that prison somewhere between 200 and 300 times. What I was taking part in was a conversation. In fact, that conversation is still going on Wednesdays and Fridays every week in the western part of the state and in several other prisons there. Usually 10 or 12 men inside would come and 3 or 4 volunteers would gather. The rules for the conversation were 2. 1, everything said will be held confidentially. 2, everything said must come from personal experience. No abstract arguments about what is so, no religious doctrine, no political doctrine, no reading from any book whatsoever. Only our own experience was to be the source of conversation. And if one man's experience or one woman, because the volunteers were in on this as equal partners with the men inside. We were not experts. We were not there to fix them or get them to manage their anger. We had no goals at all except this: to provide a field where individuals could grapple with how they might change in a direction they dearly desired to change. And that applied, as I say, to the volunteers as much as to the men inside. Why? Because we are all in prisons. Some don't know it. The men inside usually do. We all need freedom. Many men that I met inside were, frankly, more free than citizens, many, many, many citizens outside, the ones who do not see the iron bars they've built around themselves, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. On those visits at Attica, I bore witness to more focused desire to grow than I have ever seen on the outside in any kind of group, be it church or therapy group or seminars, conferences. Now, someone might say, well, Pastor, come on, of course, men in prison need to change, but we don't. So, big deal. Well, there's a crumb of truth in that. It is true that if a person does not feel she needs to change, she most certainly will not, at least not for the better. If in this country being so-called free, and you know the word is badly misused out there, especially by politicians, if being a so-called free adult means you are left to be however you like and do whatever you want, then it follows that transformative spiritual change will never take place in the ordinary so-called free adult unless there comes a severe challenge. Something like a prison that you face with bars that you don't know how to bend. Becoming aware of a desire, a thirst to change, a thirst for what is higher and not lower. This is our concern today. Thirst first. Now, what can bring an ordinary adult, perhaps even a church-going adult, to feel his prison, the size of it, the threat of it? What can bring an ordinary adult to focus on her desire to grow and to be free? This is the most basic question a human faces across the years of adulthood. How to become more free? It's the heart of the God question. It is the only question that people bring to Jesus. In all the Bible stories put together, the only real question people are bringing is, how can I become more free? It's the only question in psychotherapy. It's the only question for these men in prison that I got to meet. And yet most people, in our culture at any rate, I don't know how it goes down elsewhere. I imagine it's similar across the world. Most people fail to ask the freedom question at the needed time. They just don't ask. And this is why there is so much addiction in our society, so much despair, so much death by overdose and gunshot. Have you run across that statistic? It's been out for 2 or 3 months. That all across the Western world, there's only one ethnic and age cohort whose life expectancy is dropping. Have you come across this? It's so startling. Only white males between the ages of 40 and 60 are dying sooner than they used to. Everybody else, of every color, all across Europe and all across America, of every age and the other gender, or these days I guess you're supposed to say all genders, everybody else is still slowly living to longer age, but men of middle age, white men of middle age, are dying sooner, and mostly because of alcohol and opiate drugs and gunshots. Deaths of despair, these were called in a recent public television story on the subject. There is so much in this country. You might wish for a politician at the very top of government to speak directly to the need of men and women in despair. But we never get that. Maybe the church can talk. Generally, people do not get things right in their hearts and their heads. They do not thirst first. Now, we heard two Bible stories anchored in the experience of thirst this morning. One from Exodus, the wilderness wandering, the wilderness of sin, go figure. That is not where the word, English word sin comes from, but the wilderness of sin might as well be. The other from a dusty road in Samaria. These two are offered by the common lectionary for the second Sunday in Lent, because in Lent, Christians have a habit of trying to stay alert to the sufferings of our Lord, his hunger, his weakness, his thirst. I wasn't with you last week, but perhaps you read the story of the temptations in the desert. And so this is a time, the 40 days, of attention to thirst, to our need for God. So let's not worry whether the stories that we heard this morning really happened. Maybe they didn't. It doesn't matter at all. What matters is that in telling these stories through thousands of years, souls who thirst have been drawn to the waters of life, not automatically, but those who have ears, their ears have opened to a possibility and they've begun to experience a thirst inside themselves. Today, the question for you is, can you feel your own thirst to become more free than you are? That's all that matters. That's all we're going to talk about today. Look at the two stories. In the desert called Sin, the tradition tells that a bunch of slaves on the run from their Egyptian masters now need water. And you can think, well, that's perfectly ordinary. They're in a desert. Of course they do. And they cry out to Moses in a way that is not perfectly ordinary. They say, why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children with thirst? As if there's no answer. As if the main thing is to get back to safety in Egypt. Okay, slavery, whatever. Just stop the suffering. Israel has told the story for at least 2,500 years. Israel of old has given to all generations a magnifying lens to examine themselves, to examine yourself, to search after your own desire for freedom. For here, in this story, although the slaves are free, right? In fact, according to the story, they have all witnessed the miracle of being spared from the pursuing armies of Pharaoh. And you would think that people who had witnessed a miracle, that it might last a little while in their mind and give them a little courage for the future. But no, they're just like you and me. They quit immediately and say, why did you bring us out here to kill us and our children with thirst? They just won't go back. They're thirsty, yes, but they do not thirst in the spiritual sense. They are not empty. They're in the manner that Francis was speaking of earlier. They're not making room. They're not empty. They're full. They're full of anger and fear. They want to go back to Egypt. You know, they sound like people at a political rally where the misleader yells, let's take the country back. And the wise say, how far? How far back? All the way to Egypt? All the way to 1955? With this story, Israel asks itself the basic God question. How is it that we who have been freed still yearn to return to bondage? In the story of Jesus traveling through Samaria, it says that Jesus was thirsty. Now, you could ignore that detail. You could say, come on, he's a man. Of course he's thirsty. But gospel writer John the Evangelist has something much, much, much bigger in mind. It is in his gospel that Jesus on the cross says, I thirst. Jesus prepares for total transformation of lasting value, of everlasting value, by thirsting. Here in Samaria, he's about to use his own thirst to help a woman of a different class, a despised group, as you know, to help this woman break free from her thirst for ordinary satisfactions into thirst for life, which no earthen jug could contain. These stories, both of them, affirm that God, Holy Spirit, can move and transform a person and even a whole people. Yes, it's possible. But the stories also carry a message and something of a warning. It is this. God comes to those who thirst first. To those who wait in their thirst for a word from God. While for those who are satisfied with themselves, with their lives, with their accomplishments, with their nation, well, for those who get what they want, when they want, take what they wish, as they want, for them who are satisfied, God has nothing. God gives nothing. God is nothing. There is no meaning to God for those who are satisfied, who are already full up. God comes to the empty. You know the phrase, the rich he has sent empty away. God comes to the empty thirst first. In Exodus, the transformation of that people from a bunch of slaves into the Hebrew people, the people of Israel, will come only after they suffer much more deeply their confusion and their hunger. And then they learn to wait upon the Lord for 40 days while Moses is on the mount. And not all of them are transformed, but some are. At the well of Jacob, the transformation for the Samaritan woman. Again, it's not automatic. Something profound happens. She says, give me that water. I don't want to have to come do this chasing after water anymore. Give me some of that living water. She doesn't know what he's talking about. She is not thirsty in the deep way yet. No, he says, it seems like a non sequitur. Go call your husband. Can you imagine how her insides must have fallen into the pit? Into the thirsty pit. Go call my husband. And she tells him the truth. She says, I have no husband. And now we learn further the whole truth. You've had 5 husbands, and the man you're living with is not your husband. And a sigh. It is not our place to shame any man or woman for the trials of failed marriages. Not at all. That's not our point here. Nor, obviously, was it Jesus' point, because he did not condemn her. And though she felt undoubtedly the fear of judgment, and thus her thirst was intense, to know where she could come to freedom, because her past is filled with all kinds of emotional ragtag desires, and they weren't working well for her. She was in prison. And when he says, you have told the truth, then her heavenly thirst flies free. She knows that her life is now free. Now look, there's a reason that change of great value comes only to those who thirst and wait, and never comes to those who take whatever they find whenever they want. There is a reason that the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation, in Henry David Thoreau's phrase. There is a reason that another mass of men and women are addicted to drugs and alcohol, guns and suicide. It's not hard to say why humans despair and nothing changes in their lives and no God comes to them. It is this. Like all the animals, the human needs to be happy. Do you ever think of that in terms of a dog or a tiger? That it needs to be happy. It means something different to think of an animal as seeking happiness. The animal is seeking satisfactions of certain kinds, right? To sleep when it needs to eat when it needs to be safe. We're like that. We, from the moment we're from our mother's womb, we crave some security. Hold me. we crave some affection. Touch me. We crave some control over things. Oh, I don't know about day one of life, but pretty soon a little one wants control. Throws a cup down, shows I'm in control. Security, affection, control, these things are with us because we're creatures from the very beginning. Some of our needs through childhood go unmet, some get crushed, and we come into our young adulthood bound and determined to guard our security, to get our affection, and to exercise control over our life in some degree. Everybody does this. Our happiness hangs on our getting our way. That is a young adult, right? Especially recognizable during its turbulent teenage version. But this getting our own way, our American culture calls that freedom. Yes. That's how far the culture is from being able to raise up mature adults. Freedom is getting what I want. Bound and determined to get what I want. Listen to those words. I'm bound and determined. That means I'm in bondage. I'm in prison. And then, of course, something blocks our way. A car accident damages our spine. A war wound, a job lost, a racist supervisor, a terrible disease, a crumbling marriage. You name it. You know it. The story of your own life. Something we thought absolutely necessary to our happiness crashed or burned. Some affection, some secure place, some appropriate measure of control over our future collapsed. And with it, our happiness and our hope and our freedom broke down. It is an ancient story of bondage. It is also your story. And now comes the God question. It's the only question ever put to Jesus in all the Bible. How to become free when my happiness is lost. There cannot be a more urgent, more difficult question in all existence, because if you do not ask that question at the needed time, then your alternative is to take whatever steps you can to get back to what you thought happiness was. To get back to Egypt, the happiness you once knew. Everything you take will be a mistake. Yeah, a mistake. Everything you take when you do it on your own understanding will be a mistake. Nothing new will come. But if you wonder whether happiness is possible without the thing you thought necessary, the person, the status, the stuff, whatever it was, If you wander through a dark night, how you can become free without the good things or the goals you knew. If you hold vigil in that prayer, not knowing for how long you must hold vigil. If you thirst first and take nothing and mistake nothing from anyone or yourself, then God can come. When a person is torn from his old life, her old life, whatever were its values, its foundations, when a person is torn from the old happiness, it is possible. God knows it is not automatic, it doesn't always happen. But it is possible that if that person does not head back to Egypt, does not try to make America great again, does not insist on his own way, it is possible for him to receive life anew. Life not like any he could have imagined if he stayed his own course, mistaking his own choices. Because God comes to nothing. That is the story all through the Bible. It is the whole purpose of the cross of Christ for you. God comes to nothing. For a few years, I taught at Sing Sing Prison through the New York Theological Seminary. And sometimes I put a question to the men. Is it possible, I would ask, in your opinion, in your experience, is it possible to be happy, to be at peace, when absolutely everything around you has crashed and fallen apart? How sublime is the energy in the room each time I put that question. First, a silence. All faces suggesting that they were letting in memories of their long sorrows. Those they had done to others and those done to them and to them they loved. And then a clearing of the eye as they recalled how they had thirsted, oftentimes in prison, for real freedom. Real freedom from bondage, never mind the iron bars, real freedom. How they had thirsted. And then from a few or maybe even half of them, a joyful claim, almost a shout, yes, absolutely. It is possible to be at peace when everything round about has fallen apart. For this you must first thirst. For freedom Christ has set you free. For this was prayer and fasting made and Lent given to you, for this meditation and rest from your labors, for this the hour of worship is given, that you learn in your distress to wait upon the Lord for the gift God will give that you cannot imagine. For God comes to those who first thirst.